Welcome to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today we bring you the first episode in a special three-part series of talks selected from the 2026 Camden Conference. The Camden Conference is an annual three-day event that brings together speakers from around the world to discuss an aspect of contemporary foreign affairs. This year's theme was Today's Middle East: Power, Politics, and Players. It was held in mid-February, before the beginning of the war with Iran. This week, we're presenting talks from six of this year's speakers. You can find out more about the Camden Conference, as well as videos from every speaker and Q&A session at camdenconference.org. On today's episode, we hear from writer Susie Hansen on Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and Professor Bernard Haeckel on the politics of present-day Saudi Arabia. These talks were recorded in front of a live audience on February 21st, 2026. We begin with an introduction from moderator Meghna Chakrabarty, host and editor of NPR and WBUR's On Point, who sets our episode speakers up in the larger context of the conference, which began with sessions addressing the history and politics of the Middle East.
We've been talking about Saudi Arabia, we've been talking about Turkey, but we're going to go deep into both of those countries, beginning with Turkey and Susie Hansen. She's a journalist and an author currently living in New York. She was previously based in Turkey for more than a decade. Award-winning writer and journalist. She was a Pulitzer Prize. Her first book, let me get this right, Notes on a Foreign Country, was a finalist for the 2018 Pulitzer Prize. And her second book is coming out just in a few months. It's called From Life Itself, Turkey, Istanbul, and a Neighborhood in the Age of Erdogan. Susie, welcome.
Thank you so much. Hello, everyone. I'm very happy to be here today, and I wanted to thank all of the organizers of the Camden Conference for having me, especially Kimberly Scott, who was very patient with all of my problems. And I wanted to thank the audience for welcoming me to the great state of Maine, even in February. And I'm really very, very honored to be on stage with these amazing speakers. These are the people I call for quotes so that I sound smarter. So it's really an honor to be here. So I'm going to talk about why Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, has been in power, remained in power for over 20 years. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay. And perhaps in another way, talk about what happened to Turkey. How did it go from this aspiring democracy to this strange new autocracy? As one academic has put it, Erdogan has created a mind-blowing social, political, economic, and systemic transformation. But how did a poor kid from the backstreets of Istanbul pull off such a feat? The existing explanations are often unsatisfying, at least to me. In the years after Trump and Brexit, Western pundits and politicians divided the world between democratic and authoritarian countries. Erdogan found himself lumped amongst the strong men: Trump, Modi, Putin, Duterte, and Orban. The list never made sense to me. All of these countries are so different, their histories so unique. Westerners, it seemed, wanted to believe that these men were systemic aberrations, disruptions to some preordained timeline of democratic progress. But I knew Erdogan was the sum of myriad Turkish influences and traditions, so many of which are authoritarian, populist, and imperialist. I also knew that Erdogan's popularity had been the product of genuine political and social achievements, real improvements for his people. Even if Erdogan had always dreamed of creating a new country, which he has, his own country, the old one must have been broken enough to suggest that he could. The question to me seemed less why democracy was failing and more why 20th century nation states weren't surviving the 21st. A little bit first about how I got there. In 2006, when I was 29 years old, I won a fellowship from an organization called the Institute of Current World Affairs, to live in Turkey for 2 years and write about it. And to the graduates, please come talk to me about this fellowship. It's amazing. Although I went when I was 29 because I'm a late bloomer. I moved to Istanbul in 2007 when then Prime Minister Erdogan was beginning his second term. Now, there was a period of widespread optimism about Erdogan, who spoke the language of human rights and liberalism. This was not long after September 11th. And some Western journalists, like me, accepted him as a kind of solution in the clash of civilizations. Concerns about his Islamist roots, especially during the war on terror, were offset by the party's economic vision, its pro-business vision, which looked reassuringly Western and capitalist. In fact, the Turkish economy seemed to flourish, even when the 2008 global financial crisis happened, and the country, which was once so poor, began to look shinier, especially Istanbul. It honestly felt like a big party in Istanbul in those years. But the city was Erdogan's town. He grew up there, and his family was formed by the humiliation of the migrant experience, the flight from the countryside. Now, Erdogan grew up in Kasımpaşa, which is a neighborhood on the European side in the European quarter, but down on the Golden Horn. I know some of you have been there. And it was a poor and scrappy neighborhood, and a lot of migrants moved there. And he grew up fighting in the streets and playing soccer. And when he would get in trouble, his father, this is the story goes, would hang him from his arms. And so that might give you some insight into his psychology. It does seem like authoritarians have mean fathers a lot of the time. I went to Kasımpaşa once and I met this guy and he claimed he was Erdogan's best friend, which is like a lot of guys claim they're Erdogan's best friend. But he said, you know how he's Kasımpaşa is to watch his walk. Watch that walk. That's Kasımpaşa, which was like sort of like walking with your shoulder thrust forward. So that's the kind of reputation of the place. But the conservatives of Turkey who crowded in these urban backwaters looked for new ways of understanding how to be Muslim and prosper in the modern world. It is important to remember that the Turks had lost its great Ottoman Empire in the beginning of the 20th century. And even if they were always part of NATO and included in the American sphere of influence, they also felt ostracized and even stigmatized by the West. The same thing goes for Turkey's religious or poorer, more conservative communities. They felt rejected by Turkey's secularist, Western-looking identity. They felt excluded from its economic system, which they were. Both Turkey and its Islamists sought autonomy, independence, and dignity. And so throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, religious people and religious parties fought for a place in the country and a place in the world. In Turkey, in the beginning, the Islamists did so by working really, really hard. This was in part how Erdogan became Istanbul's popular mayor in the 1990s. He improved its roads, he improved transportation, its utilities, he picked up the trash. I mean, literally, picked up the trash. When Erdogan became prime minister in 2003, it was a victory of the most democratic kind. He was opposed by the military, the judiciary, and the country's elites. If you remember, they did put him in jail at one point. But he won by addressing poor people's concerns, by speaking their language. You can call this populist, but the oppression or discrimination he was highlighting was real. It wasn't artificial. The first 7 years of Erdogan's rule were so successful. The economy was booming. He was fixing the healthcare system. He was trying to make peace with the PKK, the Kurdish militant movement, with whom Turkey had long fought a civil war, that Western pundits touted Turkey as a model for the Middle East. In the background, somewhat out of view, Erdogan was committing injustices to ensure his own future survival. First, he was building his own business class, one loyal to him. He managed this by primarily by using his parliamentary majority, the party's parliamentary majority, to change laws around bid procurement, urban renewal, and privatization. Erdogan was able to initiate these huge mega projects, tunnels, airports, mosques, bridges, which his cronies would make huge amounts of money from, which would eventually go back to the party, which would eventually be doled out as charity to the poor. And so this created a really loyal voting class. And it also, you know, these mega projects instilled a lot of pride in people because it just reinforced this idea of, wow, Turkey is becoming this big, powerful, modern country. Second, he got rid of his staunchest opponents. His government initiated sham legal trials against secularists, accusing them of plotting to overthrow his democratically elected government. But this was for some people persuasive, because Turkey's military had staged 4 military coups in the past, each time deposing elected leaders, shutting down political parties, and calling for new elections. So some people did not see what Erdogan was doing as revenge, which it was. Its bid for accession to the European Union had forced Turkey to make serious democratic reforms. But if you remember, around 2010, Europe wasn't much excited about the Turks joining Europe. They were discouraging, to say the least. Erdogan began to take a hard look at Europe. Their countries, at the Europeans, their countries were a mess after the financial crisis. So he started to look east to new markets, the Arab world, Africa, and Russia. Then came the Arab Spring. The violence of the Arab Spring, the legacy of the war on terror, had spread to Europe and Turkey in new ways. Jihadis were flying into Istanbul Airport and then transferring to domestic flights to cities in the south and to Syria. Millions of Syrian refugees sought safety in Turkey, which would eventually enrage some Turks, especially after their own economy began to falter. In the process, Erdogan began transforming one of the pillars of 20th century Turkey, its national identity. I spent a decade reporting from one neighborhood in Istanbul where a lot of Syrians had moved. And what I noticed was it kind of split the community. Some Turks who were more secularist, Western looking, they were very upset about the Arabs arriving. They believed they had sort of left behind the Arab Middle East. This is something that they learn in school books as well. They thought that they were kind of above the Arabs. And so they did not like this reminder, and they did not like them in their country. Some of the religious Turks, however, were a little more open, as this, it was sort of part of this idea of a greater Islamic ummah. And also they listened to Erdogan, and he told them to help their Syrian brothers. But when the old national identity starts to be seriously challenged, a lot of other things start to fall apart too. Perhaps even the national ideology, and also the institutions held up by it. At this time, the Islamic State, or ISIS, was taking over large swaths of the region. Bombs started going off, first outside Istanbul, and then inside Istanbul itself. The chaos of the region caused Erdogan to fear a rebellion within his own borders, so he helped start a war in Turkey's southeast, in the Kurdish region, as well as involve himself militarily in Syria. And you will see Syria will come up again and again and again. Why did he do that? There is no foreign policy issue more important to the Turks than the Kurdish issue. With Syria at war, an offshoot of the PKK, the Kurdish militant and sometimes separatist group, had begun building a state in northern Syria called Rojava. This was a total no-go for Turkey. War abroad, as we sort of know, is often an excuse for oppression at home. In Turkey, new forms of repression followed around the time that he entered, got more involved in Syria, and was fighting with the PKK. The repression was against opposition politicians. It was definitely against journalists. It was against protesters. And I have to say that at this time, I began to feel that in the Middle East, borders were dissolving, nation states were failing, and the reversal of democratic progress in the world had begun. That's how it felt. And I'd return to New York sometimes, really surprised that everyone was continuing on as normal. But of course, this would change for everyone in 2016. I just think we had this feeling before that. So Three events around this time also really scared the daylights out of Erdogan, and I believe served as major turning points in the country's fate. And so, you know, this is not to excuse him in any way, but there were these threats. And one was the 2013 Gezi Park protests, you might remember, which was over construction and over development and the destruction of the environment. They were huge, they lasted for a month, and they really freaked him out. The second thing that scared him was the overthrow of the Muslim Brotherhood leader Mohamed Morsi in Egypt by the Egyptian military. The Turks thought the Americans were behind it because the Americans had sometimes been behind coups, and they feared they were next. And the third threat was an intra-government squabble between two groups within the government, the Erdogan faction and a group called the Gulenists. They had begun fighting, openly fighting, attacking one another, and Erdogan felt genuinely threatened by them. They were very powerful. It's not to excuse Erdogan, as I said, but it is sort of to say that we have to keep in mind and really look at the major events happening in the world when a lot of these regimes were changing. I think it's very important. And to show that this global environment in the age of globalization, mass migration, technology, transnational war, has huge effects on domestic politics. What was also happening in Syria, Turkey and Russia were working together. Putin and Erdogan were working together. Sometimes they were on the same side, sometimes they were not. But they maintained their relationship, which of course affected Turkey's relationship with the US. The other big thing that was happening was that Europe was giving Turkey billions of dollars to keep the Syrian refugees in Turkey and out of Europe, because right-wing nationalism was spiking. What that meant was that Europe wasn't exactly worrying about Erdogan's human rights abuses. He used the Syrian refugees as pawns, but it also won him a place at the big table with the great powers. So Erdogan and Turkey, smack in the middle of everything, seemed to be making themselves indispensable. That gave him a lot of leeway at home. In the years 2015 and 16 and 17, especially after the 2016 military coup, which failed to take Erdogan down, but emboldened him to give himself these emergency bigger powers, basically, Erdogan began systematically assaulting state institutions and the organs of Turkey's democracy. So that's the press, the civil society, the state bureaucracy, he fired thousands of people, the parliament, the judiciary, the universities, the unions, and the entire Kurdish minority movement. He essentially neutralized the 40% of people who did not vote for him. And the human cost was enormous. Thousands of people went to jail or were exiled or have been killed. This went on for the next decade, and it continues today. During the years starting 2018 through the pandemic into the 2020s, even as the country fell into what is truly a terrible financial crisis, I don't know if that's clear to people outside, but people are really suffering. And it also continued after Turkey suffered an enormous earthquake in 2023, in which 50,000 people died, although I don't think we really know the true number. Erdogan remained. He won more elections, narrowly, but he won them. The last time Erdogan was elected president yet again was in 2023. Again, it was after that massive earthquake for which he was blamed for the shoddy construction of the buildings. And he was also blamed for the failed emergency response. And everybody thought he was going to lose this election, actually. But I think in some ways, what happened is that when Turks had to sort of contemplate like who was going, I mean, the elections are not totally fair and free at this point, but I think that what happened was that Turkey's geography, in a way, had proved too big to fail. Erdogan had continued to make himself important to the US, Europe, and Russia, and despite increasing unhappiness about his management of things at home, his achievements still made him seem presidential on the global stage. This had been Erdogan's getaway car. The unprecedented power Turkey under his tutelage appeared to attain on the world stage. He had turned pride into, he had turned the pride that was in clean streets to the, and the pride that was in, you know, mega projects into pride in drones and military expansion. By then, not only in Syria, but in Libya, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, and beyond. When Bashar al-Assad's regime in Syria fell in 2024, Erdogan seemed to emerge a victor. The idea that Turkey had become more authoritarian during his reign was somewhat of the flaw in the conventional narrative. Autocracy always ran through Turkey's politics and state structure. What its example highlights is that countries ostensibly democratic often have deeper autocratic or repressive underpinnings than they like to acknowledge. After the years of military intervention, Erdogan, in his early years, adopted the language of free market, free markets, liberalism, and human rights, and stretched those politics of optimism into the Obama years. But the war on terror persisted and mutated into its ultimate nightmare in Syria, which unleashed that darkness in the form of terrorist states and a refugee crisis that spread anti-Muslim and anti-migrant hatred to Europe, the United States, and beyond. The surge of authoritarianism followed almost naturally. Modi, Putin, Duterte, and Erdogan, all these men, were strengthened during this period of ferment, as well as from the examples, I would say, of the Bush, Obama, and Trump administrations, all of whom offered the world during the war on terror their own versions of imperial presidencies. Who could imagine another leader then standing up for the Turks in this strange, new, dangerous world? Erdogan had turned Turkey's political trajectory into a civilizational project, an assertion of Turkey's spiritual and geopolitical significance. When I asked one of my favorite Turkish thinkers, Soley Özel, why Erdogan's people still supported him, he said, because if they renounce Erdogan, it would be like renouncing their own souls. One last thing, because I think you might be curious about this, because obviously half the country does not like Erdogan. So what happened to the opposition during these two long decades? How had they failed to protest or stop Erdogan? What did they regret? When I asked this question to all kinds of people, women in the corporate world, leftist Kurdish academics, low-level bureaucrats, liberal journalists, they all said they regretted the same thing. I was totally shocked. It wasn't that they wished they protested Erdogan more. Their answer wasn't about him at all. They regretted that in the first years he came to power, that they had not, as individuals, worked to overthrow the leadership of their main opposition party, the CHP, i.e. the equivalent of, say, our Democratic Party. And if you think I'm making a pointed analogy here, I am. For a time under Erdogan, Turks still had functional elections. The opposition could have beaten him, but they failed to recognize something early, that when the charismatic populist authoritarian comes to power, only an entirely new politics or mode of political figure can defeat him, that the world in effect has been remade by his arrival. And they have to invent a new politics, a new face for their own party. The Turkish opposition almost found that new political figure. His name is Ekrem İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul. And in 2025, Erdogan put him in jail, where he remains. The opposition was a decade late. But I won't say too late, because if living in Turkey has taught me anything, it is that no one should count that country out. Thank you.
Let's go straight next to Saudi Arabia. with Bernard Haykel. He's a scholar of the Arabian Peninsula, focusing on the politics, economics, and history of the Gulf Cooperation countries. He had a very smart question about that a little earlier, and Yemen. He is professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton and a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute in Washington, and is now completing a book on the modern history and transformation of Saudi Arabia and the rise of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. And he'll be talking about Saudi Arabia under the Crown Prince, ally, partner, or something else. Bernard.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Let me begin first by thanking the organizers, Kimberly Scott in particular, her staff, all the volunteers, all the high school students here. Love the fact that you're here. And of course, Meghna, who I'm a huge fan of hers and listen to her all the time. And of course, my co-speakers. So today I'm going to talk to you about Saudi Arabia, and I'm going to try to do three things in 20 minutes, which is very hard to do, especially for a professor. But so the three things I want to do is I want to tell you something about Saudi Arabia. I want to tell you something about the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And then I want to talk about how the U.S. should think about the country and this man. Before I do that, though, a couple of prefatory remarks. I've been studying, I'm from the Middle East, and I've been studying the Middle East for maybe three decades plus now. And I've always found that if you have illusions, and I'll explain what that means in a second, you misunderstand the place. And by illusions, I mean projecting our own desires and wishes, our own kind of vision of what the place ought to be like or should look like. It's best to sort of have a completely unvarnished, super cynical, often pessimistic view of the region to understand it. And I've always, almost always been right in my pessimism and my cynicism. So with that, let me turn to Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia is a huge country. It's bigger than Iran. It's 1.5 times the size of Western Europe. It has about 23 to 25% of the proven reserves of oil in the world. It sits on, more or less, Arabia sits on three major maritime straits. That's Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil, about 20 million barrels of oil are shipped through that strait. You have Bab al-Mandab, which is the entrance from the Indian Ocean or the Arabian Gulf into the Red Sea. And then you have the Suez Canal in Egypt, which connects the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. So strategically extremely important for its oil, for its geography. It's also the center of Islam. It's the place where all Muslims must turn 5 times a day during prayer to Mecca and the cubic building called the Kaaba inside Mecca. It also is the it contains the grave of the Prophet Muhammad in the city of Medina. So it's a hugely important country spiritually as well. And the official title of the Saudi king is not King of Saudi Arabia, but rather Guardian of the Two Holy Shrines or Guardian of Two Holy Mosques. That's his official title. The other thing about the place is that it is an absolute monarchy. It's an autocracy par excellence. It makes no claims to wanting to be democratic ever. You will never hear MBS say, I want this place to turn democratic. And even though it is autocratic, the way in which the rulers of Saudi Arabia have ruled the country has taken into account all kinds of other traditions, informal traditions, not institutionalized traditions, that have to do with how the ruler deals with his people. And those have to do with tribal traditions, religious principles, taking into account the diversity of the country, regional identities are extremely important there. And there's another cleavage that's still extremely important in the country, and that's the cleavage between the people who are settled, what are called the Hadar in Arabic, and the people whose origin is in pastoral nomadism, people who moved around all the time with their animals, otherwise known as the Bedou or the Bedouin. And that's an important cultural distinction in Arabia. And it's one, interestingly enough, that MBS, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, who's known by the acronym MBS, combines in himself, in his blood, the Bedou and the Hadar, the Bedou and the settled folk, because his mother is Bedouin and his father is a settled man. And he's an extreme, and those two traits in his character explain, I think, quite a bit of who he is, how he thinks, and why it is that he was chosen by his father to be the ruler of Saudi Arabia. Now, why was he chosen by his dad? It was because his father has a very keen sense of history and thinks that people who study in the West become effete and soft and lose touch with their own culture. Here, a prime example of this is the Shah of Iran. The Saudis are extremely aware, that is the Saudi leadership, and King Salman is very aware of what happened in Iran, and he wanted a son who was not educated in the West, who doesn't particularly speak a Western language very well. In fact, MBS is more or less self-taught in English, and who also has certain characteristics, qualities of person that make him able to rule the country. There's a proverb in Arabia, in Central Arabia, that says that the father is the falconer of his sons. Now, that's a very difficult thing to understand unless you know something about Arabian culture. So Arabians hunt with falcons. And if you are training falcons, the trainer knows which of the falcons is the best hunter. They're not all equally good. And so he chooses between his sons the best hunter, meaning the most ruthless, the most predatory, wolf-like person to rule. And that is basically one of the principal reasons why MBS was chosen, because he has those qualities or those characteristics. The other point I want to make about the politics of the region, and whether it's Turkey or it's Saudi Arabia, is that individuals matter. And we know this even from the United States. I mean, if Trump matters, his personality matters. He matters in the way the country is managed, the way the country is run, the way decisions are made. And so individuals matter. And in the field of history and in the social sciences, we often, for many decades now, have been taught, you know, don't look at individuals so much, look at bigger social structures, whether it's classes or other broader categories to understand politics. And let's not do sort of kings and battles history, because kings and battles is sort of old-fashioned and doesn't really explain much. But actually, you can't do one and not the other. Kings do matter. Individuals matter. And MBS's personality and his project matters, because he has single-handedly transformed the country in the image of what he wants it to become. And what is it that he wants it to become? He is keenly aware that oil is basically a commodity that's going to become less and less important as the energy transition takes place. And that his country, the revenues of his country, depend largely on oil. This is not a country that taxes its citizens. By the way, the GCC countries don't tax. This is the Gulf Cooperation countries, don't tax their citizens. They are what we call redistributive states. They take the money that comes in from oil sales and they essentially redistribute it, skimming some off, of course, but redistribute it to their own people. So in Saudi Arabia, you had something like 70% of the working population working in the public sector, working for the government. Most of those jobs are kind of fictitious jobs. They're not real jobs, but it's a way for the government to give money to the people by redistributing the oil money. Medical treatment is free. Education is free. If you're a Saudi and you have a rare disease that cannot be treated in the country, you can ask the government to fly you out with your family to Sloan Kettering in New York to get specialized cancer treatment. The government will pay for it. Okay, that's the kind of government it is when it comes to its people. And that is extremely expensive and unsustainable, right? Even if you have the lowest cost of production for a barrel of oil, you still need to find other ways of generating revenue. So what you need to do is diversify your economy, which means to build new sectors that are not dependent on oil so that you can create jobs, lessen the burden on the public sector and on the government, and have the private sector take up that slack. So what are the areas in which he is trying to diversify the economy? Logistics, service industries, tourism, tech, manufacturing, all kinds of different areas. And he is throwing everything at this in the hope that some of it will stick and will work, knowing that some of it will not. And this is not unique, by the way, to Saudi Arabia. The UAE, the United Arab Emirates next door, is trying to do the same thing. Kuwait is now tentatively starting to do the same thing. Qatar is trying to do the same thing, because they all see the writing on the wall and that oil eventually will not be a commodity that people will want to purchase, and they will have to create a new sources of revenue. There's a famous saying that allegedly, it's probably apocryphal, that a former minister of energy, minister of oil of Saudi Arabia, a very famous dandy-like gigolo-type minister called Ahmed Zaki Yamani. The older people here will probably remember him from the 1970s. He famously was held hostage in Vienna at the OPEC meeting by Carlos the Jackal. Ahmed Zaki Yamani said, "The Stone Age did not end because the world ran out of stones. It ended because a new technology came and replaced the stone." And that's the fear that every Saudi monarch, every Saudi leader has. So what do you do to move yourself away from that dependence? You diversify. But before you diversify, and especially if you're trying to completely transform your country, you have to centralize and consolidate power. And that is what MBS has managed to do. There was a coterie, a large group of people, the royal families, many thousands of princes. Most of them were feeding at the trough, getting contracts from the government, tripling the cost of any contract, you know, when the government was trying to build something. I can give you an example of a university that was built for women called Princess Noura University. Its actual original cost was 9 billion Saudi riyals, so about $3 billion. It ended up costing the government 33 billion riyals. And that's because the difference between 9 and 33 was pocketed by different officials and different princes who were involved in the contracting. So MBS wanted to stop this. He wanted to stop the corruption, and he wanted to castrate other members of the royal family from having any power and also having any say in how money was divvied up from the public treasury. So what he did was he threatened them. He also arrested a bunch of them, took them to a fancy hotel called the Ritz-Carlton, where he showed each one of them a large file that had been compiled on how much money they had taken, and then he asked them to give back this money. And he was able, and he used coercive means to do this, by the way, and he was able to garner, basically collect about $100 billion worth of money from this exercise, much of which has now been actually wasted on different giga projects that he's run, that he's set up, that haven't succeeded. But we'll get to that in the Q&A in case you're interested in these giga projects, like the one called NEOM. So one thing was to consolidate and centralize power. The other thing he needed to do is to turn the country, as he says, into a normal country. By normal, he means that he needed Saudi to feel on the streets and in the workplace like a normal place, where you didn't have religious zealots running around with sticks, beating women, beating men for having long hair or not being veiled or having makeup on and so on. So he needed to control the religious police and the religious sort of feature of the country, which had been the government had allowed to exist especially after the 1979. Revolution in Iran and the rise of a group of zealots that took over Mecca briefly for 2 weeks in November of 1979. So he had to tame the religious police, and he put them basically took them off the streets and put them in their offices and has not allowed them to engage anymore with the public. So there's this social change. It's a kind of social liberalization without political liberalization. There's no talk of political liberalization, but just basically allowing people to dress and behave in the way they want in the street. And so now you see women without veils, you see women with veils, but no one, you see men with long hair, with earrings, with makeup, whatever. I went to a rave in Saudi Arabia with 700,000 other Saudis. It was the wildest homosocial event that I'd ever been to. And no one was bothering anyone. And that's by design. He wants that because that's what normal means. He has also tried to limit the corruption in the bureaucracy and the red tape. Saudi today is one of the most advanced e-government countries on the planet. You can get a visa in a few minutes. You can get a passport. You can renew your driver's license. I mean, there's one app that basically allows you to interact with everything to do with the government. And this is where, by the way, China becomes very important, because the model of a surveillance state, a state that basically watches and monitors and controls everyone through tech, is the one that he wants adopted in the country. And he has fully developed it. The other thing he's trying to do is to change the ideology of the country. So historically, Saudi Arabia was officially created in 1932 as a monarchy. It really started in 1902. The ideology of the country for most of its modern history has been, this is the center of Islam, this is where true Islam is taught, this is where we propagate Islam. And in fact, from the 1950s onwards, the Saudis, in alliance with the United States and in fear of the spread of communism and leftist ideologies throughout the Middle East and throughout the world, the Saudis promoted a much more muscular version of Islam, an ideological form of Islam, often associated with the Muslim Brotherhood. And that was sort of the raison d'etre of the country. We protect Islam, we preserve Islam, and we propagate Islam. That led to extremists that the country thought could tame and control, but ultimately couldn't with the rise of Al-Qaeda after the Afghan war against the Soviets. And so MBS sees this and he says, this is dangerous. It's also a really bad brand. Jihadists don't bring tourists. So what we're going to do is we're going to crush these guys. We're going to crush the jihadists. And we're going to develop nationalism as an alternative to Islamism as the identity of the country. And so what does Saudi nationalism look like? Because this is a country of different tribes that doesn't have a history of a strong central state. It's a kind of a very violent history of tribe against tribe, and that was united in the 18th century by this one family, the Al Saud family, the family of MBS's family. And so nationalism is not about the spread of religion and how this family united these tribes and this entire territory, but rather it's about the history of this family, the Al Saud, the royal family, bringing order, stability, economic prosperity, and liberal capitalism to this wonderful space that is Saudi Arabia. I kid you not, this is how they now project a new nationalism, which is based on, you know, we give you order and we give you the possibility of being economically prosperous through trade and so on. And Islamism is no longer part of the narrative at all. If you go, for instance, to the old capital, the 18th century capital of the first Saudi state, this is an 18th century state, and you look at the museum displays, it's all about the family, and there's no mention at all that this family had used religion to unite this territory. The main religious figure of the 18th century is not mentioned in any of the displays. It's entirely about the history of this family uniting this territory. And that's what the new nationalism is about. They also created new holidays, which, by the way, in traditional Saudi Islam are not permitted. There are only two holidays that are permitted, which is the holiday at the end of Ramadan, the month we're in now, and the great Feast of Sacrifice, at the end of the Hajj pilgrimage. They've created three new national days. There's Flag Day, a new holiday. There's the Day of Founding, which is when the Saudi state was founded. They created a new date for that out of thin air. And they also have sort of another national day that they celebrate. And the country shuts down for these three holidays. As I said to you, this is not unique. What I just described is not unique to Saudi. You see it in the United Arab Emirates. In fact, the United Arab Emirates tried to diversify its economy about 10, 15 years before the Saudis began in 2016, 2017 to do this. And you really do see in Saudi Arabia a serious transformation. You can feel it in the texture of interactions with people. There are many, many more women in the workforce. The women, as pointed out earlier, are better educated, harder working, more disciplined, and they're the better human capital of Saudi society. And MBS knows this. He's not a feminist, by the way. Just like Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore is not a feminist. He just sees, like, who are the better people? Let's deploy them. Very pragmatic in how he thinks about resources at his disposal. And I can say a lot more about him because I've met him about 30 times now. And I get to know, I've played video games with him. He's a big video gamer, big time. Very interesting character. Very complicated person. His mother has had a huge influence over him. He's also extremely solicitous. Like, when you're with him, he notices whether your cup is empty and you need more coffee, whether you're hungry. There's something about him that's quite unlike the other Saudi princes that I've met over the years. Now, let me end by just talking briefly about the United States and how the U.S. should think about him and about Saudi Arabia. So in America, we have this constant tension in our foreign policy between what I would call the idealists and the realists, okay? And the idealists are people who want good things. They want democracy, human rights to be spread and to see those things in other countries. And the realists are focused often on just core interests. So the two kind of ideal types of this way of looking at the world. And by the way, the idealists are not just left-wingers. You also have right-wing idealists, right? The neocons are idealists. The ideal type of the idealist is probably President Jimmy Carter, okay? And the ideal type of the realist is President Trump. Just purely transactional, doesn't care about the internal workings of countries. He even says it. Gave a speech in Riyadh, said, I don't care how you run your countries as long as we can do business and make money. That tension runs through our history, and it's not an easy one to reconcile. And you can be more on one side and be more on the other. When it comes to Saudi Arabia, there are certain core aspects to the country that every American president immediately realizes once they come to office. And you saw this very clearly with President Biden. President Biden started out wanting an idealist, wanting to punish Saudi for its human rights violations, which are many. And then once the Russians invaded Ukraine, he realized that, boy, we need Saudi Arabia on side when it comes to oil production, because otherwise oil prices can shoot up. And if you remember, there was a time when the gallon hit $7 in California, and everyone was blaming President Biden for this, and then there were these midterm elections that were coming around the corner in 2022. He didn't want to lose them, so he wanted the price to go back down. So he sends his national security advisor to Saudi to ask for more oil production, because the Saudis have what is called spare capacity. This is oil that they can produce almost at will if they choose to, but choose not to in order to regulate the market. So President Biden's turned from being an idealist to being a realist fairly quickly and developed a very strong relationship in the second half, in the last year and a half of his term, with the Saudis, because he realized that they are important for global economic stability, for dealing with Russia, dealing with China. And so that's a tension in our history. Now, the way to think about MBS, if you're an American, I think, is to say, okay, there are a lot of things you're doing that we like. You know, diversifying your economy, socially modernizing, becoming normal, treating women better, that's all wonderful. But there are things you do that we don't like all your human rights abuses, we don't like. And it's actually bad for your image, it's bad for your brand, it's bad for tourism. So how do we try to deal with him given that reality? Other things, by the way, that we like about him is that he's trying to build his own military capacity so that he doesn't have to rely on the United States as much, as it were, carry his own water militarily. He's also trying to, you know, now, the first 5 years or so were a bit nutty when he was consolidating power. Now he's this force for stability and order in the region. He's trying to reach out to different countries, trying to bring peace to the Sudan, for instance, intervened with President Trump on that. So all of that is good. But how do you deal with the question of human rights? So I found that when dealing with autocrats like him, like MBS, it's very useful to engage them in private on matters that like human rights, and to try to pressurize them in private, not in public, because in public you make them lose face and you embarrass them. And to try to get them to do things that you want them to do. And both President Biden and President Trump have been relatively successful, not entirely successful, when it comes to the freeing of prisoners of conscience and human rights, prisoners that whose human rights have been abused. There are about 3,000 human rights prisoners that we would consider prisoners of conscience or political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. And in the last year and a half, MBS has liberated about 1,000 of them. Now, they're not entirely free. Some of them have bracelets or anklets on their, you know, they're under house arrest or they're confined to the country. By the way, he's done this to some of his brothers too. It's not just, you know, people who criticize him for his politics. But there has been some movement in that direction. And I think that one should encourage him more in that way. Again, I think more privately is more effective than publicly. And then one should also encourage him to keep doing a lot of the things that he is doing, which is basically to make Saudi Arabia a normal country. Thank you.
You've been listening to Speaking in Maine on Maine Public Radio. Today's program was the first in a three-part series of featured speakers from the 2026 Camden Conference, which focused on the current politics of the Middle East. We heard from writer Susie Hansen on Turkey and Professor Bernard Haeckel on Saudi Arabia. Both talks were recorded on February 21st, before the war with Iran began. You can find this episode on our website at mainepublic.org. Click on shows to find Speaking in Maine and many other on-demand programs. You can also find a link to more info about the Camden Conference and archives of other talks there. Music in this hour comes from Our Alarm Clock. Susan Tran is the executive producer of Speaking in Maine, and today's program was produced by me, Jane Donahue. Thanks for joining us. This is Maine Public Radio.